From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Sometimes food is what we make of it. It's drama, transcendence, and glory. So why not golden sausages?
You need to get pure gold, and then you literally just roll the sausage across the leaf, and it takes the gold, and the gold will stick to the sausage. It's really, really easy.
Today, we encourage you to play with your food. We'll spend time in the kitchen with food writer Harold McGee at the celebrated L'Etoile restaurant. Find out what's new at the cutting-edge Moto, where chef Omaru Kantu is serving donut soup and smoke. Also, an insider's look at the world of competitive eating.
I got there out in the hot sun. There's the greatest competitive eater alive today. In my opinion, one of the greatest athletes alive, sitting right next to me. And I was on 6 burgers when he was on 36 burgers.
Stephen Gates is a self-proclaimed Epicurean desperado, living for wild culinary quests, weird food, and hardcore feasting. Gates covers food for the BBC and is the author of the book titled Gastronaut. To Gates, a gastronaut is someone who will stop at nothing to experience the transcendent moment through food, no matter how bizarre. He says, staging your own emu is one way to go.
It's where you take a whole, either a pig or a whole sheep or a whole deer, and you dig a vast pit in your garden, or, well, preferably somebody else's garden, and you have to create a huge fire in the bottom of this pit. And you need to take out about 1.5 tons or 2 tons of earth. So a big, big pit. You create a huge fire, and then you, on top of that fire, you have to put about a metric ton of iron, which you can pick up from your local scrapyard. And you feed this fire for about 3 hours until the iron is absolutely red hot. Meanwhile, you wrap up your whole animal in lots and lots of bed sheets, and then wrap all of that in foil around the top, and then another bed sheet around that again.
You're making this up, aren't you?
I'm not making it up, I swear. I've done this one. And in fact, it's quite a big thing in New Zealand and Australia. They'll call it a hangi out there.
Okay, you've got it wrapped in yards of bed sheets and covered with foil, and then...
That's right. And then you lower it down onto the red-hot iron, and you use iron because it's the one thing that will retain heat for hours and hours and hours. In New Zealand, they'll use volcanic rocks, but in North London, they're quite hard to come by. So you lower your pig down to that, and then you get all of the soil that you dug out, and you throw it back on. So you basically bury this pig all over again. Now, I've found that all of the processes of getting the iron, digging the pit, negotiating with your mates to let them dig up their garden, this tends to take about 7 days, and getting all of the stuff together and ordering your pig, it's a huge operation. And then once you've lowered your pig into the pit and covered it up, that's another 8 hours. You leave it there to cook for about 8 hours, and it basically sort of steams and braises in this pit. The point is, it might take a long time, but it will feed, it'll often, you know, a large pig can feed 60 people.
Well, this is clearly a recipe that is not going to be pursued by just anyone at any time. There are others that seem a little bit more accessible, although I'm not sure how appealing they are. For instance, you have one recipe in which you cook with gold, which sounds luxurious, but I don't know how good for you it is.
Well, gold, in actual fact, gold is entirely inert. It has absolutely no nutritional value whatsoever. There's a great saying from some of the earlier nutritionalists, like Pliny the Elder, and that is that every single substance on earth is bad for you. You can die from water, you can die from eating too much bread. There is a poison, a toxin level for every single substance. Now, eating a little bit of gold is absolutely fine. I've done quite a bit of research in this with doctors in the UK. It basically gives you nothing except golden teeth and a slight feeling of fear. And most of my friends, when I make golden sausages, most of my friends tend to say, is this going to clash with my fillings? Is it going to make my teeth, set my teeth on edge? And also, are they going to have golden poo at the end of it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no, sadly. Maybe you're laying a golden egg, but certainly not golden poo.
I see.
And also, you'll tend to get little bits in your mouth. But doing these things, especially with the gold, I mean, that's an interesting one, because it doesn't make the food taste any different at all. It's purely psychological. But when you do these things, it takes a meal with your friends and makes it ever so slightly transcendental. You're not quite sure what's going on, but there's just a magical sense in the air and fear.
Now, you talk about cooking with gold. Is this something that anybody can do? I mean, can you help me through the process of doing this?
It's gloriously easy. It's so easy to do. You need to find some gold. Now, that's the first stage. Generally, you'll find this very easily from art shops. A lot of people use it for gilding frames, or they'll use it in paintings. You need to get pure gold. Now, pure gold is 24 karat gold. If it's anything less than 24 carats, it tends to be cut with copper and nickel, so always best to go for the pure stuff. And it's sort of bizarrely cheap. You buy a book of gold, and you get about 25 leaves, and I think it's less than $30.
Which, so do you just take a leaf and wrap it around your Cheeto and go from there?
Exactly. I'd say sausages are an easier thing to start with. Cheetos are slightly more complicated. But what's great about a sausage is it's got a little... You have to cook them first. Sausages cooked first and then let them cool for a little while. And what's great is they've got a very thin layer of fat around them. And so the gold will stick very easily to the fat. You wipe off most of the fat, but make sure it's just a little bit sticky. And then because you get this transfer leaf, you literally just roll the sausage across the leaf and it takes the gold, and the gold will stick to the sausage. It's really, really easy. Mm. And I swear, your friends will come around, have supper with you, and remember that golden sausage for the rest of their lives.
How long do you look at it before you put your fork in it?
Well, basically, you have to go through all of their questions first. They'll have all of their neuroses and they'll be very surprised, and then they'll be slightly mesmerized by it. And the first person will have a little bite, and everybody will be watching and waiting to hear them say, "Oh my God, that tastes really strange." And then everybody will start digging in. It takes a little while, but and it's absolutely fine. I wouldn't eat them every night of the week because there have been no tests done on chronic ingestion of gold. But every now and then, once a year, you can have a golden sausage, I'd say, at least once a year.
And I must say that it sounds more appealing to me, although there is that element of fear in there, than the suggestion that you cook with a variety of aftershaves.
Yes. The aftershave one is interesting because it's one of the few recipes in the book that absolutely doesn't work. And the book's very, very clear about this, that it seemed like a brilliant idea at the time. I was in the house thinking, I've got some friends coming around. I'd really like to do something strange, something that will make them stop in their tracks. And I was looking at my wife's perfume and moisturizers and stuff, and whether or not I could moisturize a leg of lamb. And then I thought, no, that's not going to work. And then I saw my aftershave, and I liked the flavor of it. And I thought, well,
you liked the flavor of it?
It sort of makes me smell vaguely presentable in the morning, so it can't be such a bad thing. And also, it's a combination of spices and herbs with alcohol, which is no bad thing, really, for me. And so I thought, well surely this must be good news. And I thought, there can't be anything wrong with it. I'm only going to use a little bit of it. Of course, there's a lot wrong with it, because I went to the website of the people that make Old Spice, and they said chronic ingestion is likely to cause mass nausea, all sorts of different medical problems. But of course, you know, I wasn't planning on drinking a lot of it. I just needed a little drizzle. So I went ahead, and in actual fact, I made a ceviche, which I thought would be best. And you don't really cook anything, so I'd keep all the flavours. And I tasted it, and I thought, this is absolutely fantastic. And for the first sort of 20 seconds, I was thinking, this is genius. I'm going to conquer the world in ready meals with a little pack of aftershave with them. And then after about 20 seconds, you get this blinding sourness that surges up from the back of your throat and basically envelops your head. And basically, there are lots of ethanols and strange alcoholic residues left in the aftershave, meaning that it's really bloody horrible.
Now, you talked about Pliny the Elder, which suggests that you have done a fair amount of research into the history of food. In fact, I know that you have written about some of the most magnificent feasts of all time, and I wondered if you'd tell us about some of those.
Well, I guess the classic feast is Trimalchio's feast. It was a hedonistic extravaganza, which I think can be safely described as an orgy, although there wasn't a lot of sex involved. And it's as much a piece of theatre as a culinary experiment. But it was lots of pigs with sausages spilling out of them and opening up a cake and live things crawling out. And in certainly Roman times, there was a good gastronautical strain where people liked to shock other people, and they like bringing strange foods back. And I think this is beginning to happen now. People are enjoying exploring with food a lot more. The only trouble with Trimalchio's Feast is it was actually all made up. It's a story as part of a longer book, but it has gone down in history as one of the great suppers of all time. Mm. Obviously, there's the Last Supper, which must be the most famous meal of all time, although the food is rarely mentioned. It was your basic Passover meal. Yeah. There are interesting things about that. When you look at pictures, there's a picture of the Last Supper, I think is it in Mexico? I can't remember off the top of my head. But in the Last Supper there, what's in front of Jesus and the disciples is actually a guinea pig, a roasted guinea pig, which goes to show that
it does seem unlikely, doesn't
the world.
It?
Exactly, but it's much more part of the culture.
Now, for those of us who are really tired of dull dinner parties, you know, serving the same thing each week, you suggest staging your own Bacchanalian orgy, and I wonder, I have no experience of this, I confess, and I wondered if you could kind of lead me through. What do you need for a good Bacchanalian orgy?
Well, the whole thing about an orgy is I obviously can't guide you on the sort of sex element of it, but it's all about theatre, really. The modern Bacchanalian orgy is a combination of intellectual sort of discourse and insane food. So you can make violet wine. If you can catch any dormice around your house, they're great, sprinkled with honey and poppy seeds. Small birds, quails would do, but in times of your little fig peckers would have been the thing.
You know, I'm beginning to see why there isn't much sex involved in this.
Well, a lot of food and everybody would be feeling slightly queasy. Is that what you're thinking?
It did cross my mind, yes.
There is actually, bizarrely, there is a cookbook that comes down from Roman times. It's called The Roman Cookery of Apicius, who was, well, it's a little bit hazy as to exactly who he was, but there's certainly a cookbook ascribed to him. And in there are hundreds of recipes. It's absolutely fascinating because it's a snapshot of how people ate in Roman times, a proper snapshot. I'd say it's probably our earliest proper cookery book. There are recipes that have been found much earlier than that, but it's our earliest proper cookbook. The other things that you can do are just doing things that are surprising. Mock turtle soup, rhinoceros soup, you can buy deep-fried insects on the internet. There are lots of sites in Thailand that will send you these things. Small animals tend to be very popular. If you can get your hands on a suckling pig, that tends to help. And then you need to sort of stage it. I'd recommend getting cushions out on the floor, kicking all of your sofas out of the room and putting down a big rug with all of the food on the floor and lots of cushions for people to hang out on. And then get your friends to read some poetry. If you've got any friends that any good on the guitar, get them to try. And obviously everyone should wear a toga.
Stephen Gates is an Epicurean desperado who covers food for the BBC, and he's the author of the book Gastronaut. What do chefs at high-end restaurants talk about at their conferences? Well, in Spain this year, subjects included making flan with tree pulp, inside-out sushi, and how to serve smoke. From Europe to San Francisco, restaurant kitchens are starting to move into some very new and very high-tech experimental food. Our technical director, Kirill Owen, decided to see what's cooking in Chicago. She sat down with Chef Homaro Cantu before dinner at his genre-bending and, let's face it, mind-blowing restaurant, Moto.
The year of eating dangerously, that's what we're calling it. My husband and I are trying to eat our way through some of America's best, most innovative restaurants. Dangerous? To our wallets, certainly. And there's only so much a health club can do about the after effects of a lot of fine dining. But also dangerous to one's preconceptions of what makes good food. Which brings us to Fulton Market in Chicago this frigid February evening. On a block filled with semis, corner coffee shops, and meatpacking plants is some serious destination dining. Moto, the high-tech home of Chef Homaro Cantu. Chef Cantu told us about what we might expect to see on our table.
That's the sound of 130 pounds per square inch of carbon dioxide releasing from a fermentation chamber. And inside we have carbonated fruit salsa.
carbonated fruit salsa. This is going to pop in your mouth.
Yeah, I'm not going to let you taste it until tonight because it'll ruin the experience.
Pomaro Cantu is one of America's most avant-garde chefs, one who mixes humor, haute cuisine, and high science. His dishes include lobster with freshly squeezed orange soda, goat cheese snow, and donut soup. Along with that carbonator, his kitchen tools include polymer cooking boxes, liquid nitrogen, and a laser. Cantu and his design and engineering partners, Deep Labs, have patents pending on so many culinary inventions that I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement just to walk through the Moto kitchen doors. Anything in here that's being used that just is unusual in a kitchen?
Yeah, pretty much everything. Those gas tanks over there, styrofoam containers that we use to work with liquid nitrogen.
What do you use the liquid nitrogen for?
We do an inverted flapjack where we take a pancake batter, we make pancakes, and then we puree it into cooked pancake batter. Then we take that pancake batter and stick it onto a plate that's been frozen in liquid nitrogen. It freezes one side, we flip it over, it freezes the other side, and then you eat this thing that melts in your mouth. Tastes like a melting flapjack, but it's actually cooked. We call it the inverted pancake.
So, is this haute cuisine or high science?
You know, I don't really think of it as science. I just think of it as tinkering. We just tinker with things. And if we can't figure out how to make something, then we can talk to people that we consult with who understand science, and then they'll educate us a little bit about it.
Who are some of the people you consult with?
Well, we're consulting with NASA on a project called a food replicator. We're working on a project with the NIAC wing of NASA called the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts. What these guys do, you ever hear of that space elevator? They wanted to take a big tether and put it on the moon and then have this thing go back and forth. Sounds like some real cockamamie stuff. But they're really making this thing. And so they asked us to create the world's first three-dimensional food replicator along with another company called Icosystems, where you push a button and one of 300 dishes pops out the other end. And it works on basically printing technology, which we have a patent pending on. We have a food replicator here, but it only replicates food in two dimensions.
The food replicator is an inkjet printer. The ink, edible dyes, and reductions, the paper, is made from rice. Your menu for the evening comes printed on a bed of dip to be scooped up with chips.
We do a dish where we serve the dish, and then we serve you the recipe of the dish, and all the components that are in that dish are on the sheet, so you can taste it in the two-dimensional form. You know how to make it. But you see, the whole point of all this stuff, like the food replicator, this is much more than just playing around with paper food. We can take pharmaceuticals and put them on there. We can put, you know, dental care on there. You throw something in there that tastes like a rabbit, but it's got, I don't know, Celebrex in it and, you know, breath freshener, something that fights cavities. And then we could take it a step further than that. We can implement nutritional value, calories, amino acids, all this stuff. So you could put a stack of papers in your pocket and live on it for a week with just that and water. Now, it doesn't take too much to imagine where we can use this technology. You know, we're talking with some heavy hitters about stamping out world hunger with this stuff.
From a stack of paper in a pocket, how far is it to futurist favorite meals in a pill?
Well, we are working on pills for dinner. We actually got this chemical in yesterday that enables us to encapsulate fats, and then the fats turn into a powder. I actually just purchased a pill press today, so we're going to take this powder and compress it down, then you got yourself a bacon pill, which is kind of cool.
So when you roll out something like edible paper, what do diners do? How do people react? And have you ever put anything out on the tables that diners have just reacted so badly to that you've had to pull it?
From time to time, there is a course or two that people may not dig. You know, there's this course right now that we call Black Seafood. It's a course that comes out looking pitch black, like it was charred in an incinerator. But here we're asking the question, you know, you have to strip away your sense of sight and just eat the dish for what it is. We tell them it's calamari, lemon, and creme fraiche. That's exactly what's on there. But we make it look like it's been charred to a pulp. You know, it's a little weird for people to look at. And they go, you know, they just determine right away, I'm not going to like this. But then they eat it, and it's like, wow, that was really good. You know, it didn't taste anything like what it looked like. So as humans, we automatically have these preconceived notions as to what tastes good. This is where this project with NASA becomes very interesting. You know, let's say that the only way that we can create meat in outer space is to create it in a Petri dish. You know, our astronaut's going to sit there and go, hey, this tastes good. It was created in a Petri dish in a lab, and it didn't go moo. I mean, that's a hurdle that we all have to get over.
Is there ever a danger that the theater, that the fun, or that the science will overwhelm the seriousness of the food?
No, because the bottom line here is that this stuff has to taste great. If it doesn't taste great, it's just a joke. I think that for the longest time, fine dining has been this stuffy white tablecloth hellhole that, you know, everybody winds up shelling out way too much money for. You got to wear a jacket and tie. You know, I'm not knocking all the fine dining restaurants out there. That's just the way it's been done. That's the French model that has existed for 200 years. And, you know, dining should be fun. Eating should be fun. It should be like a kid going to Chuck E. Cheese for the first time. My goal here is just for people to have fun with food. It's really what it's all about. And to actually expect the unexpected when they come here.
What are you planning to do with that laser?
What we're going to do is some caramel laserized wine notes this evening. You're going to have a dish that's paired with a red wine that's aged in oak. And whenever you age red wines in oak, it imparts a sort of vanilla-like quality because the same compound that's found in red wine that's been aged in oak is found in vanilla beans. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a piece of Madagascar vanilla bean, put it up against the laser, and incinerate it at 2600 degrees Fahrenheit. When we do that, the smoke that comes up is going to go into your red wine glass. We're going to trap the smoke in there, bring it to the table. You're going to flip it over. That smoke is going to emanate around the table. You're going to experience this. And then we're going to pour the wine in there. And because the smoke has gone into the glass, it forms a micro-thin film of soot in the glass. And it pairs well with the wine. So we're pairing smoke with wine.
And serving smoke. It was an amazing meal. I'll plan on checking in with Chef Amaro Kanto again when he opens his first restaurant in space.
Chef Amaro Kanto at Moto in Chicago, Illinois. He spoke with TT Book Technical Director Kirill Owen. If you're interested in a sample, you can find Chef Kanto's recipe for tomato salsa jelly at our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, the spices of the East shake up a small Irish town in the novel called Pomegranate Soup. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Marsha Maron grew up surrounded by the evocative power of food. Maron was born in Tehran, but grew up in Argentina, where her parents ran a Middle Eastern cafe. These days, she lives in Ireland, where she wrote the novel Pomegranate Soup. It's the story of Iranian sisters who turn a small Irish town on its ear with their sensual Iranian cooking. Maron told Anne Strangechamps that her parents fled Iran after abandoning plans to come to the United States. Her father went to pick up his visa the morning the revolution began.
That morning he was lined up was the same morning that the revolutionary students took the embassy hostage.
Oh, my goodness.
So he had completely horrible timing. You know, if he had gone a day before, maybe things would have been different. I'm not sure. But, you know, he went home and everything fell apart. They weren't able to come to the United States like they had planned. And, you know, they were desperate to leave. And they had friends who had left to go to Argentina. It's one of the countries that was very open to immigrants. And they decided to go there. They went to Buenos Aires. The three of us went, my mother, my father, and I.
Hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, they gave up a lot of their dreams and they had to survive. They didn't know Spanish. They knew English, but they didn't know Spanish. And they had to, you know, find a way of making ends meet. And they opened up a cafe. And that's where my love affair with food and Persian food began.
Well, like you, your characters in Pomegranate Soup are Iranians set against a Western background. And, I mean, in this case, it's an Irish small town. It's quite a contrast in cultures you've created. I mean, you've sort of deliberately made these Iranian sisters just like a magical breath of richness and beauty mm-hmm. against this small Irish town. Tell me about the two cultures you're wanting to portray here.
Well, they're not as different as at first glance. I married an Irishman, first of all. I've been married to him for 8 years, so I'm Irish in a lot of ways now. But the two cultures have a lot of similarities, and there's the language, the love of the language. They both have the love of poetry. The Irish family is very strong, and so is the Persian family. So I began to see there's something the same. But as far as having these three Iranian sisters come into this town and be different, the big difference between the Irish and the Iranians is the food. Big difference. You know, Irish people are great drinkers. Iranians cannot hold their alcohol. And vice versa when it comes to food. You know, Iranians, their cuisine is one of their cornerstones of their culture. It's considered a great art. And what I discovered living in Ireland, living with an Irishman, is that food is just there for sustenance. You know, it's not there for flavor. It's not there for enjoyment or pleasure. And, you know, Ireland has changed a lot in the last 10 years. And, you know, they've discovered a lot of cuisines and a lot of ways of making even traditional Irish food to make it more interesting. But I think in the 80s especially, it wasn't something that was the norm. And, you know, it's a nice, gentle clash, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, well, describe something of the impact these Sisters Cafe has on this Irish village just in terms of the food, the introduction of these new smells.
Yes, smells are really important in this book. They're actually the first sign of the sisters' arrival. Before they're even seen, the smells are seeping through the cafe doors and out into the main street. Cardamom and cumin and rose water. Absolutely foreign smells, absolutely exotic smells, and you would not have found that, you know, in Ireland back then. Nowadays, you can go to the supermarket and get a few of those things, but back then you wouldn't have in 1986. And, you know, these sisters pronounce themselves in this sensual way, and it completely shakes up the entire village. They just don't know what to make of it.
You said this cuisine is considered one of the great arts in Persian culture. Tell me more about that. In what way?
Well, the Silk Road ran through Iran. It connected the West, Europe, to the East. And a lot of our words that we use for food in the West come from Persian words. And so it has always influenced Europe and the West. For Persians themselves, food is fundamental to family structure. The mother is a very important figure in the family home, and she's the primary cook. And when families in Iran, especially now, not Iranian Americans as much, but Iranians themselves, gather for meals three times a day, they gather around the sofre, which is this blanket that they put on the floor, and they all sit around it, and usually in an order of the head of the household down, and they meet at the corners of the sofre three times a day, something we don't do in the West now. Even at the dining room table, you know, it's not really used for that anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's just a base food for the family. And as far as art goes, it's such a delicate cuisine. It takes a lot of patience, a lot of just intuition. You know, it's handed down through the generations, and people don't usually write recipes down, you know. It's just a little bit of this, a pinch of that, and it's unlike any other cuisine.
What are some of its signature dishes?
Well, it has to do with the balance of sweet and sour. Some of the signature dishes, I mean, what the West would know, they would think of kebabs, which is nice, but it's not really that important. Rice is the biggest staple, buttery, saffron-infused rice at every meal. Bread is another thing. Cheese, yogurts, herbs, like bunches of basil and mint and dill. These are actually eaten by, you know, sprigfuls, and you just put them in a wrap of bread, and that's a wonderful meal. And tea, fragrant tea. These are just very basic, but these are the, you know, the everyday sort of meals that people eat. And then there is a vast array of stews as well. They smell wonderful.
Are there particular Persian recipes, maybe some of the ones you've included in your book, that are your favorites?
There's a couple that I really love in the book, and there's some that I haven't included. And there is the elephant ears, the fried fritters that we call gushafil or elephant ears, you know, because of the memory of my mother making them for me and how sinful they are, you know. And I absolutely love the duh, which is this yogurt minty sort of drink. You know, I think the Indians cuisine has a similar drink to it. And always, always come back to the saffron rice, which is so comforting, with the tadik, which is this pancake fried like potato lining. I don't know how else to tell you. You have to taste it. But they're all comfort foods for me. You know, simple, very simple foods.
And it's interesting listening to you talk how it reminds me how strongly food, it's not just that it's food, it's when it's linked to memory. I mean, your memory of your mother making elephant ears for you, you know, and I'm sure everything you describe, I'm sure, is linked to some strong memory for you. I mean, that's what makes food so magical.
Yes. It's memory of home, memory of mother, I think, you know, comfort. And there's nothing as primary, as fundamental as that first bite your mom gives you, you know, that mushed up, you know, spoonful of food that you get to chew for the first time. Everything is back to that. I mean, you know, at every party, everyone gathers around the kitchen. There's a reason behind it. Absolutely. I think it comes back to mother, always.
Marcia Marin is the author of the novel Pomegranate Soup. She spoke with N. Strange Champs. It's easy to appreciate a perfectly prepared dish at a 4-star restaurant. What's harder is understanding the chemistry of cooking. But then Harold McGee wrote a book about just that subject. It's called On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. It became an overnight classic and has been called the most widely quoted culinary work in English. McGee was in Madison recently and stopped by the kitchens of the celebrated L'Etoile restaurant to give Anne Strangechamps a guided tour of food science. McGee gave running commentary, while Chef Tori Miller fried up some bacon and onions.
So what's actually happening when Tori cooks bacon?
What's happening at the surface of the bacon is that the sugars and proteins that are part of what make up bacon are reacting with each other. They're kind of breaking apart and then recombining with themselves and with each other. Now, chemists still don't understand exactly what's going on. They understand the first couple of steps, but after that it gets so complicated that they haven't really cataloged all the different molecules that are formed in the process.
That's amazing. Something that is a mystery to science, and yet most of us, we encounter this in our kitchens, you know, a couple times a week.
Exactly. Like, I can cook bacon and onions, like, every day and be happy for the rest of my life. There's just something about the smell, and when you add the onions to the bacon, it just takes me back to a place that just makes me want to actually crack a couple eggs and throw it right in there and right. and get a couple forks and we'll be good to go.
Harold, do you think are we evolutionarily kind of coded to love that smell, the smell of browning meat?
You know, that's a really interesting question and something that I've wondered a lot about, because browned aromas and flavors did not exist during our biological evolution. They've only existed in our experience for the last, what, maybe 10, 15,000 years. And we haven't evolved that much in that short a period of time. So for me, that was a fascinating question. Why are these smells so attractive, given the fact that our ancestors never would have encountered them?
So what do you think? I mean, why are those? Because there is nothing like that smell.
Yeah. My explanation, which pleases me but still leaves me a little unsatisfied, is that the important thing about the flavors that are generated in cooking is their complexity, their richness. Yeah. Because if you think about our ancestors on the savanna or wandering through the grasslands looking for something to eat, their senses were probably much more alive than ours are, because we can kind of take our food sources for granted. They had to be paying attention to what they could smell in the wind, in the air, and on the ground, and so on. And I think when, for example, they came across a ripe fruit of some kind, that must have been such an explosion of sensation that it just must have stuck with them. And it seems to me that what characterizes ripe fruit, which is a food that's actually meant for animals to eat, it's meant to attract animals to disperse the seeds, fruit has a very complex flavor. It has aroma, it has sweetness, it has saltiness, it has savoriness. It's a very mouth-filling experience. And I think when we cook, what we're doing is, in a way, making something kind of like what fruit was for our ancestors, something that fills the mouth and just satisfies those senses that we have.
Have you ever, Harold, from your knowledge of chemistry, thought of new flavor combinations that you might not have thought of from a sensory perspective?
No, my mind doesn't work that way. I have friends, chefs, whose minds do work that way, and so they'll actually look at lists of flavors in different foods, because chemists have done some analysis of that kind, and then they'll see the same thing in two different columns and say, I think maybe chocolate and caviar would go together, and then they mix them together. That's one example of an idea that Heston Blumenthal in England came up with after looking at these lists of flavor compounds. But what that's the way his mind works.
Did that work? Chocolate and caviar?
Most people who have it enjoy it, but not everyone. And I would say that that's true of pretty much all foods, that there are some people who just can't stand cheese, for example.
But so now what's the science behind that? He looked at the flavor compounds and realized that caviar and chocolate share some of the same molecules?
Yeah. And so he thought, well, maybe those will serve as a kind of bridge to bring these two things that we don't normally think of as going together.
What other things go together like that?
Well, we have a very good example right here with the bacon and the onions, because one of the things that characterizes meat as an ingredient is the fact that it's largely protein. And protein has two atoms that most other ingredients don't have, starches and fruits and vegetables. It has sulfur and it has nitrogen. And those two elements give the flavor of protein a very specific kind of quality. And the wonderful thing about onions is they're a very rich source of sulfur. Very different compounds, but then if you put them in the same pan with meat and cook them together, the sulfur in the onions reinforces the sulfur in the meat and makes the meat taste meatier, and the meat makes the onions taste meatier, and so you get this wonderful synergism.
Isn't that lovely? It's like, if you want to use a musical analogy, like a chord that creates a harmony.
Yeah. In fact, that's the way I try to think of flavor, is exactly that way, that we often think just in practical terms that the flavor of meat is the flavor of meat. But in fact, the flavor of meat is a combination of hundreds of different sub-flavors, if you will, and all put together, they make the flavor of meat. And so it really is more like listening to a chord than like listening to a specific note. And once you begin to think that way, then you can see, well, that onions have particular overtones, meats have particular overtones, put them together and you stretch out the chord.
And is that what you do too, Tori? Are you paying attention to the undertones or the overtones in certain ingredients to think about what might marry well with something else?
With this particular ingredient, like with bacon, I just think that bacon is delicious. And then I would think, well, what would make bacon more delicious? Maybe some onions and some aged cheese and some tomato soup, you know, maybe a little wine, you know, and that's where, like, I come from, I think, as far as thinking about ingredients, you know, and in dishes, adding a little bit of heat, a little bit of salt, a little bit of acid, you know, that sort of thing is the chef-y stuff that we get to do. But in combinations, I think, is really where, you know, dishes come together for me. And I always try to think of dishes as their parts and then as their wholes. And then in the end result, like you say, is that harmony that comes out of that chord. I think it's a great analogy.
And Strange Chefs in the Kitchen with Harold McGee, author of On Food and Cooking, and Chef Tori Miller of L'Etoile Restaurant in Madison, Wisconsin. Coming up, a peek inside the world of competitive eating. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Badlands on the vocal cords. We gonna rule this world. Thought you should know. And check it out, yo, it's a go. I'll be that top regurgitator extraordinaire. One of each to the beat and the flash of flare. Eat you out of house or home, no thought or care. Fringe empty, cup is bare. The one that rips snacks out of school backpacks. It's looking over the shoulders, baby. Like Michael Jackson, I'll be there eating like Pac-Man.
Some original music from competitive eater Badlands Booker. The phenomenon of competitive eating began in 1916 on Coney Island as a promotion for Nathan's Hot Dogs. Since then, it's gone on to become a highly organized activity some people call a bona fide sport. There's even an International Federation of Competitive Eating. There are big stars, big money, and bigger stomachs. Journalist Ryan Nurs fell in love with competitive eating in New York and has gone on to become a competitive eating MC. Nurs is the author of Eat This Book. He told Steve Paulson about one of competitive eating's stars.
You have Eric Badlands Booker, the competitive eating-themed hip-hop guy, who, you know, he's normally a pretty convivial sort, but relatively a little bit shy. He has a little bit of a stutter. But then, you know, somehow over the course of competing in these contests, he created this alter ego called Badlands Booker. The name Badlands was given to him by a New York Post writer named Gersh Kunstman, and he just went with it, and now you see Eric off the stage, and then when you see him on the stage, it's this new kind of overconfident, almost like a World Wrestling Federation character, where he's beating his chest, and he's saying hoo-ah to the crowd, and then you've got another guy named Tim Janis. He's named himself Eater X. He's a Wall Street. He's got a mask that he paints on his face every time he goes, and the mask fits whatever he's eating that day. He used to be a Wall Street trader, and he stopped being a Wall Street trader, but he would have this day life of going to Wall Street, trading, and his night, you know, or his weekends would be painting his face and going and eating competitively.
Now, you've been more than just an observer in all of this. You've been an MC at some of the events. What does that involve?
Well, it's not just being an MC. First of all, you're also producing the events. So at any given event, say a watermelon eating contest, you have to decide what's the time limit for the contest. How much watermelon are we going to put in front of each person? Are we going to weigh it before and then weigh it after? And if so, what kind of scales do we need? There has to be an emergency medical technician at every competition, just in case someone suffers a reversal of fortune, or in case someone gets a little ill or chokes. And you've got to think of how you're going to introduce all the characters. I end up every person, say there's a local kid who wants to eat watermelon, I will give him a persona that he doesn't even know he has before he's coming up on stage, you know? I will say that he was the Cap'n Crunch eating champion of his neighborhood and that he tore the roof of his mouth and the scars took a long time to heal, but the psychological wounds took even longer. And here he is back at the competitive eating table today, you know, and that sort of backstory. And so you have to create a sort of drama, and you have to make sure that the contest beforehand is organized such that at the end of it, you can calculate exactly who won and what their totals are, which can sometimes be difficult, actually.
You mean what their totals were? Isn't it just a matter of how much they ate?
Well, the thing is that traditionally, it was just things like hot dogs and burgers and stuff like that. So there, yeah, you can just say how many hot dogs they ate. But now what it's turned into is you have multiple chicken wing eating contests. And chicken wings can basically only be done in terms of weight before and after. So you end up with these big trays filled with chicken wings. And you weigh them before, and you have to subtract what they weigh afterwards, and that difference is their total. And that is the way that it has been going with a lot of things, because now there's more and more money involved. You know, the first prize for a lot of contests is $2,500, second prize $1,500. These guys, you know, end up winning by 4 ounces, so you can't just calculate when it's something like lobster or watermelon or chicken wings, you have to calculate in terms of weight before and after.
You know, I think the only eating contest I was ever a part of, it was just a backyard party. It was a watermelon eating contest. I have to say I won.
Nice work.
Yeah, and it was just gobbling, chowing down that watermelon, seeds and all, of course. And I just remember a lot of liquid pouring out of my nose afterwards. And it was pretty gross, I have to say.
Yeah, you know, well, some people see it as gross. Some people, you know, see it as a sort of, after a while, you see a certain physical poetry about it when you see someone like Kobayashi, you know, putting down 53 and a half hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. It almost transcends that disgusting element and becomes something that you actually enjoy watching.
53 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes?
Yes, that's the present hot dog record by Takeru Kobayashi of Japan. He makes about $200,000 a year on the Japanese circuit. He once did a competition called Weight Crash, where he ate for 45 minutes Japanese buffet food and gained 26.6 pounds
oh
in 45 minutes.
God. Well, and the amazing thing is I've seen pictures of him. He's not a big guy.
That's right. That's the way that, you know, competitive eating, just like any sport, it evolves. At first, it was the sport of every man, and the fat guys kind of get their chance to play. And now, just like any other sport, it's evolving towards the smaller and slightly more athletic. You've got Kobayashi, weighs 145 pounds. He's in unbelievable shape. He's got a six-pack. He's very muscular. Then the second best eater in the world is a woman named Sonia Thomas. She weighs 100 pounds. She stays in great shape, and she comes out and beats all the men.
This woman is 100 pounds? How much can she eat?
Well, Sonia the Black Widow Thomas, as she's known, she has some pretty stunning records, actually. She ate 46 dozen oysters in 10 minutes, which takes aphrodisiac to a new level with the oysters. She ate 65 hard-boiled eggs in 6 minutes and 46 seconds. She ate 11 pounds of cheesecake in 9 minutes. She ate 30, how many hot dogs did she eat last year? 38 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. She won Wing Bowl. I don't know if you've ever heard of Wing Bowl, but it's a eating contest slash sort of orgy bacchanalia that fills an entire arena in Philadelphia at 7 in the morning. The Wachovia Center, where the 76ers play, fills with 20,000 people, and it's just a stage filled with large men eating chicken wings and strippers bearing their midriffs behind them. And it's one of the most insane events that I've ever attended.
Now, I would think to be a champion competitive eater, you've got to have good technique. I mean, I don't know, there must be some tricks about how much to chew the food and certainly how to swallow it.
That's correct. And I think that the main things are stomach capacity, esophagus control or swallow control and swallow timing, and even with some events, your bite strength and your chewing strength. Some of these guys, I know Badlands Booker, before a contest that's a really chewing heavy contest, like a pickle eating contest, he will chew packs of gum, he'll chew 15 packs of gum a day to work on his jaw strength. Then you have most of the guys right now are using a water training technique where they see how fast they can put down a gallon of water. And some of them, like Joey Chestnut, Ed Cookie Jarvis, these guys are putting down a gallon of water in less than 45 seconds, which is pretty incredible. So they are capable of controlling their esophagus and controlling the swallow and being able to do it very fast. It's almost like a sword swallower, where you can control these esophageal sphincters. There's one that's kind of high up in the esophagus. There's another cardiac sphincter that's lower down. And they are able to control whether nausea will set in. You know, they are able to control the gag reflex. And someone like Kobayashi is obviously very able to control just swallowing large chunks of unchewed food.
Now, you faced off against Kobayashi once, didn't you?
I did indeed, and I would have to say that I did nothing if not confirm my utter lack of talent in competitive eating.
What happened? Well,
it was a qualifier for Crystal Burgers. Crystal Burgers are a little bit like White Castles, the prototypical slider, as they're known. And I did train. I trained with all kinds of stuff. I trained with the water training. I ate, you know, massive amounts of oranges. I ate massive amounts of bananas. I ate Mexican food. I did all this stuff. But when it came down to it, I got there out in the hot sun. There's the greatest competitive eater alive today. In my opinion, one of the greatest athletes alive sitting right next to me. And I just could not, I just cannot swallow fast enough to even begin to compete. I was on 6 burgers when he was on 36 burgers. 6 burgers. And I heard, I was so proud when I hit 6. And I looked over at him, and they had a number behind him that said 36. It's so depressing. You know, you just realize you have no talent. And I think that basically, if I trained and trained and trained, my swallowing skills are just so poor that it would take a long time for me to ever do the deuce, which is 20 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. So I think I'll probably have to hang up the fork after that.
There's a part of this process we haven't talked about, which is what happens once the contest is done and you put in 12 pounds of food or something like that, or 20 pounds of food. Don't you have to get it out?
It's a valid question, one that some competitive eaters are a little reluctant to talk about, but I have pride and I have gotten to the bottom of some of it. The term in competitive eating for letting the food come up prematurely is a reversal of fortune, or suffering urges contrary to swallowing. We don't like to use the P word, but if that happens during the contest, they are immediately disqualified. We often say that, you know, Elvis has left the building and get the guy off the stage. After the contest, and a reasonable amount of time has passed and they seem to be okay and we go through the awards ceremony, they are allowed to go off and do their thing, and it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy. What I've heard from talking to the eaters is that some of them estimate that around 20% actually will get rid of the food by puking afterwards. Most of them, however, it's sort of a thing of pride to keep it down. I have heard of some use of laxatives. Mm-hmm. But even that is not very common. For the most part, for example, Kobayashi said that the day that he vomits after a contest is the day he retires. It was as if he did that after a contest, he would have to commit harikari. I mean, he was very adamant about keeping it down, and that a real food fighter, which is what he calls himself, not a competitive eater, but a food fighter, a real food fighter not only eats the food, but absorbs the food. And that is part of the competition. And that is what separates a real food fighter from an average guy who can just eat a decent amount and then do whatever, throw it up or anything like that.
Ryan Nurz is the author of Eat This Book. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickard, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Kirill Owen is our technical director. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Techno Cuisine, number 49B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.